Welcome back to CM Property Digest, your premier source for in-depth insights and engaging conversations about property matters across Africa. Over time, we've explored diverse topics such as green financing, corporate due diligence, quantity surveying, property development and management, and marketing within Kenya's real estate sector, often featuring prominent industry figures. Today, I'm excited to introduce our guest, Mr. Emmanuel Mumia, the esteemed chairman of the National Environment Tribunal, NET. With extensive knowledge in environmental governance, Mr. Mumia will share his thoughts on the critical role of the tribunal in balancing development with sustainability and the pressing environmental challenges impacting the real estate industry. Thank you for joining us, Chairman.
Thank you for having me.
Let's dive right in. As a relatively young lawyer, you assumed the significant responsibility of leading the National Environment Tribunal. How has this appointment shaped your career and influenced your perspective on environmental sustainability?
That's an interesting question. The term relatively young lawyer is fitting because ideally, such a role requires at least 10 years of post-admission experience as an advocate of the High Court. I was appointed chair of NET with just 7 years of post-admission practice. This achievement is a culmination of several factors. I've often found myself in leadership roles early in my career. For example, I became a partner at a law firm at the age of 28 and chaired the Dispute Resolution Board of UDA at 33, among other responsibilities. The role of chair has been immensely impactful, both in terms of responsibility and shaping my understanding of sustainable development. The tribunal operates in high-stakes sectors such as construction, where the EIA, Environmental Impact Assessment License, is crucial. Our decisions often involve balancing immediate development needs with long-term environmental sustainability.
That's impressive. What's the most fulfilling aspect of your work as the chairman of the National Environment Tribunal?
For me, it's ensuring that even in the most contentious cases, decisions are made in a manner that satisfies all parties involved. A truly effective judicial system allows even those who lose a case to leave with the feeling that justice has been served. That sense of balance and fairness is very fulfilling.
Could you give us an overview of the tribunal's primary mandate?
Certainly. The tribunal is a product of the Environmental Management and Coordination Act, EMCA, of 1999, though operations began in 2002. Our primary mandate includes hearing appeals on decisions made by the Director General of the National Environment Management Authority, NEMA, particularly concerning EIA licenses. These appeals must be lodged within 60 days, a deadline that cannot be extended under Section 129(1) of EMCA. We also handle disputes related to forest conservation, human-wildlife conflicts, and land-based projects under various legislations, including the Forest Conservation and Management Act, the Wildlife Conservation and Management Act, and the Climate Change Amendment Act of 2023. These are broad areas that require meticulous oversight.
That's indeed a wide mandate. Now, with the recent operationalization of the 2024 National Building Code, do you foresee any changes or impacts on the tribunal's work?
I've not engaged deeply with the 2024 National Building Code, as it primarily focuses on building and construction standards, which fall under the purview of other regulatory bodies. However, one area of relevance is noise pollution from construction sites. Recently, we made a decision on noise control under the Noise and Excessive Vibration Pollution Control Regulations of 2009, which aligns with provisions in the new code.
What types of disputes does the tribunal encounter most frequently?
The majority are appeals related to EIA licenses. These include disputes over license issuance, conditions imposed, or outright denial by NEMA. We also see cases involving human-wildlife conflicts, often appeals from county wildlife compensation committees. Additionally, there are general complaints about environmental rights under Article 42 of the Constitution, drainage issues, and noise pollution.
Another question would be, what types of environmental disputes does the tribunal handle most frequently?
That's a good question, and ties in with the earlier one about significant issues for the tribunal.
Yes, exactly. The highest number of cases we handle are challenges to environmental impact assessment, EIA licenses.
Yes, challenges to EIA licenses are at the top. These are followed by cases arising under the Wildlife Conservation and Management Act, which often relate to human-wildlife conflicts.
Human-wildlife conflict, such as appeals from county wildlife compensation committees.
Exactly. We also see cases brought under Section 129(2) concerning decisions made by the Director General or committees of the National Environmental Management Authority, NEMA.
Okay, could you elaborate on those?
Sure. Some of these involve issues like drainage disputes, framed as environmental matters, or decisions tied to the right to a clean and healthy environment, under Articles 42 and 43 of the Constitution.
Have you encountered cases under the Climate Change Act?
Not yet. Climate change disputes haven't been brought to us so far.
Why is that?
It's a fairly new area, and I think it requires more public sensitization. The same applies to concepts like carbon credits. They're not widely understood even among lawyers.
That's interesting. So on that note, what role do lawyers play in carbon credit transactions?
Their role is minimal. Carbon credits are primarily transactional and often involve multinationals. Lawyers mostly act as transaction advisors, especially in cases involving land-based projects tied to greenhouse gas emissions reduction.
I see. Could you explain how carbon credits work?
Carbon credits quantify activities that reduce or remove CO2 emissions. One credit equals 1 ton of CO2 reduced or removed. These efforts are often disruptive in land-based projects, especially for communities, as they may involve activities like afforestation or reforestation.
Shifting gears a bit, are there challenges or opportunities for developers and regulatory bodies as they adapt to the new standards in the National Building Code?
Definitely. Challenges include compliance, sensitization, and the initial investment required for green building designs. Although the long-term benefits make sense, the upfront costs can be a barrier.
And opportunities?
There are significant opportunities for circular economy practices, particularly in waste management, and for innovation, creativity, and technology adoption in construction.
Regarding appeals from NEMA, what's the typical time frame for the tribunal to determine such cases?
Ideally, we aim to make decisions within 60 days, guided by Section 130 of the EMCA. However, delays are often caused by parties or lawyers, not the tribunal.
Does the tribunal provide advice to NEMA on specific issues?
We mainly provide oversight and make recommendations in our decisions on improving processes like license acquisition. While we have the power to offer advisory opinions under Section 132, we haven't been called upon to do so yet.
Given global challenges like climate change, how does the tribunal support the UN Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, particularly climate action?
Our decisions are anchored in sustainable development principles, which align with climate justice and action. For example, nullifying licenses that defy sustainable practices supports these goals. Additionally, under the Climate Change Act, we handle disputes arising from land-based projects tied to carbon credit initiatives.
On a global scale, how does NET contribute to addressing rising temperatures and global warming?
We support efforts under frameworks like the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement. By resolving disputes tied to carbon credit projects, we indirectly contribute to global climate goals.
What about local concerns, like the rise of high-rise developments in low-density areas?
I can't comment on specific cases, as they're often ongoing.
Fair enough. Looking ahead, what's your personal vision for your role in the built environment?
I'd like to play a more significant role in climate justice and climate financing. This involves advising on the viability of projects and ensuring funding supports sustainable development.
What's the current level of public awareness about NET's role and functions?
Public awareness has grown, especially among the elite, but more sensitization is needed. Access to justice has improved with online hearings and partnerships with judiciary offices.
For someone wanting to learn more, where can they find resources?
The NEMA website has a section on NET, and our decisions are available on Kenya Law.
Finally, what steps can Kenya take to promote responsible development and sustainable environmental governance?
Strict enforcement of existing laws is key. The Environmental Management and Coordination Act, EMCA, is robust but needs better implementation. Citizens also have a role to play through responsible practices like renewable energy use and proper waste management.
Thank you for your time and insights, Emmanuel.
Thank you as well. Embracing the Future: Approaches to ESG in Real Estate, article by the Simon Rutto. Introduction. As climate change, social justice, and ethical considerations continue to echo in the wake of the global transition towards sustainability, real estate players are increasingly recognizing the value of integrating ESG principles in their investment and development strategies. Indeed, gone are the days when real estate embodied the epitome of capitalism, as awareness is growing that real estate can have a significant social impact. With the real estate property sector accounting for a chunk of greenhouse gas emissions, it is therefore essential for the sector to start grappling with ESG issues. As such, ESG regulation and compliance in real estate has now emerged with the aim of entrenching environmental protection and conservation, social justice and responsibility, and good governance practices in business operations. ESG criteria for real estate. Understanding ESG in real estate. Property financiers, institutional investors, asset managers, property owner, or project developers are increasingly focusing on ESG as they are expected to address ESG requirements, act accordingly, and document these actions in a verifiable manner. Simply put, ESG environment, environmental responsibility, social responsibility, and governance, good corporate governance, is about comprehensive sustainability and ensuring responsible investment as mandated globally. To understand how ESG affect the real estate sector, it would be amenable to branch out and examine the individual components of ESGI. E for environment. This captures the ecological responsibility in the context of ESG and real estate, where carbon footprint, soil and soil environment, climate risk, technical and design aspects, materials used and their environmental impact, water supply and usage, as well as air quality, are examined. S for social. Social responsibility is part of ESG for real estate players. As property does affect social well-being and contribute directly to society, key factors in social impact include user experience, occupancy rate, surrounding environment, well-being of users and community, flexibility of property use, and corporate social responsibility. CSR policies, among other impacts, are considered. 3G for governance. Good corporate governances refer to corporate policies and practices addressing the societal role of property. By considering ethical investments, business continuity, data subject security, investment viability, this element addresses the policies and procedures that ensure leadership and integrity in the management of properties. Relevance of ESG in real estate. Importance of ESG in real estate. A market competitiveness integration of ESG can lead to brand positioning and attract potential investors, tenants, and customers for commercial spaces, as sustainable practices continue to resonate with socially and environmentally conscious consumers of real estate products. B. Risk mitigation. By incorporating ESG factors, real estate players can identify and mitigate risks associated with climate change, changing regulations, and reputational issues, where proactive management of both social and environmental risks can protect the long-term value of real estate assets. C. Efficiency and cost savings. Energy-efficient buildings and resource management strategies can result in significant savings, as investing in sustainable features leads to reduced operating costs, low energy consumption, and increased property value over time. D. Long-term resilience. As climate change-related extreme weather events become more frequent and severe, properties built and managed with ESG principles in mind are better equipped to withstand and recover from these hazards. Environmental, social governance, legal, and regulatory framework. Kenya's ESG landscape is fast evolving and moving towards the codification of ESG standards, ESG reporting frameworks, and monitoring and evaluation of compliance with ESG standards across various sectors. Locally, the Constitution of Kenya forms the basis towards ESG compliance, as it underscores the principle of intergenerational and intragenerational equity by mandating the right to a clean and healthy environment for the sake of present and future generations. Through guarantee of socioeconomic rights of its citizens, various legislations have been developed towards a sustainable environment, including the Environmental Management and Coordination Act 1999, EMCA, which establishes the National Environment Management Authority, NEMA, to oversee environmental matters and policies. EMCA affects the real estate sector through provisions on environmental planning, conservation, how to conduct environmental impact assessment and environmental audit, and monitoring, all of which must be complied with. B. The prevention, protection, and assistance to internally displaced persons and affected communities. Act 2012 touches on prevention and addressing internal displacements resulting from development projects and where there are compelling and overriding public interests. C. Under the Companies Act 2015, directors, including directors of real estate companies, are required to include information on the impact the company's business on the environment in their annual report, business review. D. The Climate Change Amendment Act 2023, while providing for a robust framework for the regulation of carbon markets in Kenya, touches on implementation of projects through a community development agreement, especially where community land is involved, to ensure community development. E. Mwongozo Code of Governance for State Corporations is established toward the management, governance, and oversight of state corporations by encouraging boards to adopt a holistic approach to social, economic, and environmental issues in the core business strategy and take account in their decision-making the impact of the organization's operations on the community and the environment. F. The Nairobi Securities Exchange NSE ESG Disclosure Manual 2021 provides for a standardized form of ESG reporting for listed companies, including real estate companies, though it may also apply to non-listed companies that wish to integrate ESG in their strategy, operations, and performance management. G. The Capital Markets Authority CMA Code of Corporate Governance Practices for Issuers of Securities to the Public 2015 mandates boards to disclose a statement policy annually on governance and status of compliance with the code, while addressing matters relating to board operations and control, rights of shareholders, stakeholder relations, ethics and social responsibility, accountability, risk management and internal control, and transparency and disclosure. Aside from local law and sectoral guidelines, various international standards and initiatives have been developed by local jurisdictions, which have eventually been globally adopted as follows. As the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment, initiated in 2006, outlines the principles for responsible investments to include incorporation of ESG into investment analysis and decision-making processes, incorporation of ESG into ownership policies and practices, appropriate disclosure on ESG issues by the entities invested in, promotion of acceptance and implementation of principles, working together to enhance effectiveness in implementation of the principles and reporting on activities and progress towards implementation of the principles. In implementing these principles, signatories representing a majority of the world's professionally managed investments contribute to developing a more sustainable global financial system. EI, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, CSRD, developed under the European Union EU legislation and announced during COP27 regards ESG and non-financial reporting. It makes it mandatory for real estate players to report on their inward and outward ESG actions by considering social and governance factors. While more countries are also bringing forward sustainability-related disclosure requirements, Kenya can borrow from developed countries to enhance its ESG stance in the global transition and influence sustainable investing in her real estate sector. J. The Global Real Estate Sustainability Benchmark, GRESB, adopted across 64 countries, is used to assess and benchmark ESG performance of real estate investments, where it is best suited to guarantee the preservation of your assets' value by highlighting extra financial performance. It serves to confirm the organization's fund's commitment to ESG standards, which now play a vital role in the market's assessment of an asset's overall value. K. The Carbon Risk Estate Monitor, CRM, is a sector-specific transition risk measurement tool and an EU-based initiative with the object of decarbonization of the EU real estate sector and focuses on financial risks associated with climate negligence. It is meant for use in assessing standing risk and report the financial implications and losses arising from poor energy performance. L. The standards include Leadership in Energy and Environmental Assessment Method, LEED, was developed for improving the environmental performance of buildings by including rating systems for existing buildings, interiors, and neighborhoods. MILI Building Research Establishment Environmental Assessment Method, BREEAM, was launched as the world's first green building rating system towards ensuring sustainable design of buildings, where it provides a comprehensive framework for sustainable construction. As the world is catching up to meet Paris Agreement climate targets, the decisions made at COP27 exhibit the resilience needed and opportunities for transformation needed for future environmental health. From the foregoing, the borrowing of ideas, mechanisms, strategies, and tools between countries, to the universal acceptance of initiatives, is seen as a universal approach of dealing with climate change. By equipping developing countries with the necessary resources to contribute effectively to global efforts, the understanding of the climate crisis and how to address it effectively has never been much clearer. Key areas affected by the impact of ESG. As ESG considerations become integral to real estate decision-making, the industry is poised to lead in sustainability and ethical business practices. By adopting ESG principles and integrating resilience and adaptation strategies into developments, developers can reduce their environmental footprint, mitigate the impact of climate change, safeguarding investments for the long term. The following illustrate how ESG principles reshape real estate towards a greener, more equitable, and well-governed future. By building and construction considerations, are energy efficiency and green building standards. Implementing energy-efficient practices and designs involves optimizing building envelopes, incorporating high-performance insulation, and utilizing advanced heat, ventilation, and air conditioning systems to minimize energy consumption. Green building standards encourage the use of eco-friendly materials, efficient waste management practices, and the integration of renewable energy sources like solar panels and wind turbines. BREEAM and LEED are widely used in measuring green building standards and sustainability certifications on environmental performance buildings. As such, green certified buildings command higher market values and attract environmentally conscious tenants and investors, hence reinforcing the financial viability of sustainable real estate projects. B. Renewable energy integration. Solar panels, geothermal systems, and wind turbines are increasingly being incorporated into building designs to harness clean, sustainable energy, hence reducing dependency on fossil fuels. Renewable energy systems reduce the overall carbon footprint of properties. Properties utilizing renewable energy not only often benefit from government incentives, grants, and tax credits, but also note substantial cost savings over time, hence making these investments more financially attractive. C. Sustainable materials and construction practices. Opting for eco-friendly materials such as bamboo, reclaimed wood, and low-volatile organic compound paints, and recycled steel is crucial in reducing the environmental impact of real estate developments. Sustainable construction practices such as prefabrication and modular construction allow for precise manufacturing in controlled environments, reducing material waste by optimizing material usage and minimize on-site construction time. D. Water conservation measures. Techniques such as rainwater harvesting and sewering for non-potable uses like irrigation and toilet flushing significantly reduce reliance in municipal water supplies. Low-flow fixtures including showerheads and toilets are designed to minimize water usage without compromising performance, leading to substantial water savings. Grey water recycling systems can treat able to reuse water from sinks, showers, and laundry for irrigation and other non-potable applications. Additionally, efficiency irrigation systems such as drip irrigation and smart controllers optimize landscaping water use, reduce wasted, and promote plant health. By prioritizing water conservation, real estate developments can contribute to environmental sustainability, ensures regulatory compliance, and appeal to eco-conscious occupants, all the while helping preserve a critical resource and operations systems for property owners and tenants. E-social responsibility in community development. By focusing on creating inclusive, equitable, and supportive environments, real estate developers can contribute in community development by investing in, say, affordable housing projects, hence addressing housing shortages and promoting social equity. Integrating community amenities such as parks, recreational facilities, public spaces, and wellness centers such as gyms and even EC0 spas foster social interaction and enhances residents' quality of life. By focusing on social responsibility, such as ensuring buildings and public spaces are designed to accommodate people with disabilities and engaging the community during construction planning process, helps in building more resilient, stronger, and inclusive communities by addressing local needs and concerns. F. Ethical governance and transparency. Real estate firms should implement strong governance practices such as setting clear policies for ethical conduct, accountability, and compliance, which are crucial for building credibility and trust in the real estate sector. Implementation of comprehensive ESG reporting frameworks by real estate firms to effectively disclose their sustainability performance and governance practices is crucial for building trust and credibility in the sector. Incorporation of ESG reporting frameworks, such as the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, SASB, and the Global Reporting Initiative, GRI, to effectively disclose their sustainability performance and governance practices allows investors, stakeholders, and tenants to assess the developer's commitment to ethical behavior and sustainability. Fostering a culture of fair labor practices, anti-corruption measures, and equitable treatment of stakeholders ensures ethical governance is observed, hence promoting regulatory compliance and promotes long-term business sustainability. G. Green financing and investment. Financial instruments can have favorable terms and incentives for meeting specific sustainability criteria, hence encouraging developers to prioritize environmental and social goals. Sustainability-linked loans, energy-efficient mortgages, and green bonds are some financial instruments that provide developers with capital needed to implement ESG-focused projects. By aligning financial strategies with ESG principles, real estate firms are able to develop green-certified buildings that tend to have lower operating costs, higher occupancy rates, and increased market appeal, making them attract ethical investors, secure necessary funding, and overall contribute to the global transition towards a low-carbon economy. The real estate ESG score as a valuation benchmark. The main aim of valuation of property is take into account of all features relevant to its valuation, where alongside cash flows and property risks, building characteristics, quality of the location and environment, impact of the property on society and its economic sustainability are considered. ESG criteria have a major influence on the market value of real estate and need to be incorporated in valuations by incorporating sustainability criteria at the level of revenue, cost, and capitalization rates. The sustainability criteria include energy efficiency, water efficiency, use of recycling materials, or ease of maintenance, among others. Once sustainability criteria have been established, its impact on the property's cash flow has to be quantified, where the discount rates can be adjusted in line with the property's sustainability characteristics. Proper reporting on add-ons and deductions of sustainability characteristics of the property being valued ensures that the presence or absence of such characteristics is monetized. In order to value the impact of ESG criteria, relevant scenarios reflecting different developments in environmental, social, and governance factors have to be identified to evaluate the impact of climate change on the climate resilience of a location and therefore on real estate values. The influence of these factors on operating costs, market demand, and long-term value trends can then be analyzed. As such, incorporating ESG criteria in real estate valuation is an important step to better understanding the long-term value of properties and minimizing ESG risks. Risk mitigation. In the context of ESG and sustainability, risks may either be physical climate risks or transitional climate risks. Physical climate risks arise directly from direct physical impacts of climate change, such as acute risks from extreme weather events such as storms or floods, and even long-term and permanent changes in rainfall patterns or number of heat days per year. Transitional climate risks, on the other hand, result from the societal, political, technological, or economic changes stemming from efforts to fight climate change. Investors and business leaders have now become particularly interested in companies that could manage ESG-related risks effectively and protect their investments long-term. For instance, in the wake of wildfires experienced in the Los Angeles Palisades in the United States of America, affecting entire neighborhoods, and the Isiolo County fires in Kenya, leading to more than 300,000 acres of grazing land, the real estate industry will experience pressure on property risk and site assessment industry to adapt. By proactively managing risks and incorporating ESG policies into operations, real estate companies can adopt strategies such as carbon reduction initiatives, reforestation programs, and the role of sustainable urban planning in liaison with relevant government authorities in preventing and mitigating the effects of wildfires or climate change-related risks in general. These unfortunate and devastating fires serve as a stark reminder of ESG's crucial role in the real estate industry, and companies where they must adapt to the changing ESG expectations to stay competitive and mitigate property and resource risks. By ensuring regular due diligence, building a property portfolio strategy, and demonstrating their commitment to sustainability and ethical business practices, and identifying opportunities for change and innovation, companies can position themselves on solid ground for a more sustainable future. Incorporating ESG into real estate decision-making. The following can be used as actionable steps to foster sustainable and responsible real estate practices. Conduct ESG assessments. Firms can evaluate existing and potential real estate assets based on ESG criteria to identify areas for improvement and assess risks and opportunities. B. Set clear ESG objectives. By establishing quantifiable ESG goals aligned with the organization's mission and values, these objectives can guide decision-making processes and demonstrate commitment to sustainability. C. Promote innovation and collaboration. Encouraging innovation in sustainable technologies and practices within the real estate industry can help foster collaborations with industry peers and experts to share strategies and address common challenges. D. Engage stakeholders. By involving tenants, local communities, and investors in ESG initiatives, this can help to build a shared vision and foster support for sustainable practices. Conclusion: integrating ESG principles and criteria into real estate investments and developments features a smart business decision as it leads to more thorough risk assessment and better decisions, including financing. By considering ESG factors, real estate decision makers can enhance market competitiveness, mitigate risks, and contribute to a more sustainable and equitable future. Embracing ESG in real estate demonstrates a commitment to responsible practices that benefit both the bottom line and the well-being of communities and the planet as a whole. By reviewing and adapting internal strategies, policies, and procedures to embrace ESG responsibilities, it is prudent for real estate firms to review and adapt their internal strategies, policies, and procedures to embrace environmental, social, and governance responsibilities.
Acquiring Kenyan residency through investment in real estate and agriculture. Sectors article written by Wahu Wambugu, Advocate of the High Court of Kenya. Email wambugu@cmadvocates.com. Introduction. There are various ways under which one may become a resident of Kenya, which is dependable on the nature of the activity one intends to undertake here in Kenya. Investment in real estate and agricultural sectors is one of the notable ways through which a foreigner may acquire residency status in Kenya. This article aims to discuss in detail this aspect of the acquisition of residency status through investment in the mentioned sectors. Key aspects of property ownership by non-Kenyan citizen. It is important to note that the Constitution of Kenya under Article 65 allows for the holding of land by non-Kenyan citizens. However, it also stipulates some restrictions in that they can only hold a leasehold tenure not exceeding 99 years. It is also important to point out that a company or a body corporate fully owned by a foreigner S is also considered a foreigner for purposes of land ownership. Property ownership by foreigners for investment in the real estate industry. The real estate industry in Kenya plays a vital role in the country's economy, and hence the government supports real estate investment. Foreigners who wish to invest in real estate and property development while residing in Kenya should apply for an investor's work permit under Class G. This permit is normally subject to renewal every two years. Class G permit is issued to a person who intends to engage, whether alone or in partnership, in a specific trade, business, consultancy, or profession, other than a prescribed profession, i.e., regulated professions such as doctors, lawyers, etc., in Kenya. This category of work residence permit requires one to have a registered company here in Kenya to undertake real estate investment. Additionally, one may also undertake investment in partnership with others. To qualify for this residence G work permit, one must at least provide proof of investment capital of at least $100,000. It is worthwhile to note that the Director of Immigration Services may request additional proof of other available funds, since investment in some real estate sectors requires huge capital. In addition, one must also obtain the relevant licenses, approvals, and requirements to enable one to invest in the real estate sector. Non-Kenyans investing in the real estate sector must understand that to be granted the said work permit, one must demonstrate that the investment should be of benefit to Kenya. Property ownership by foreigners for investment in agriculture and animal husbandry. The agricultural sector in Kenya is regarded as the backbone of the country's economy, and therefore no doubt is a very crucial sector whose value cannot just be underestimated. Foreigners who wish to invest in agriculture and animal husbandry, whether alone or in partnership, should apply for an investor's work permit under Class B. This permit is normally subject to renewal every 2 years. One major prerequisite of this residence, work permit, is that one must provide proof of land ownership in Kenya and investment funds of at least $100,000. Such investment should be of benefit to Kenya. Furthermore, one may also opt to register a company and purchase land through a company, especially whereby one intends to undertake investment in partnership. It is also crucial to understand that while applying for this residence, work permit, in some instances, one may be required to provide the necessary license, S, from the relevant authorities. This will, of course, be dependable on the nature of the proposed investment. How can a foreigner own a freehold property in Kenya? As discussed above, foreigners can only own leasehold tenure, not exceeding 99 years. Hence, they cannot own freehold properties. However, with increased demand for land in the country, some foreigners, especially the ones investing in the field of agriculture and animal husbandry, may end up having to purchase a freehold, agricultural land, which could be more suitable for such investments. This is because most leasehold properties have quite a smaller acreage, which may easily limit investors who wish to venture into agriculture and animal husbandry. In such instances, whereby a foreign investor identifies a freehold property which is suitable for the proposed agriculture and animal husbandry, the only way to own it is by undertaking conversion, i.e., conversion of the freehold tenure to leasehold tenure with the Ministry of Lands and Physical Planning. Instances when a foreign resident can become a permanent resident citizen. It would be important to note that a foreigner upon holding an immigration residence permit for a continuous period of seven years, including the two classes of investors' permits discussed above, i.e., Class G investment in real estate and Class B investment in agriculture, he/she is eligible to apply for Kenyan citizenship or permanent residence under the lawful category. N.B. Upon successful grant of such lawful citizenship, one shall have a right to own freehold or agricultural land, just like any other ordinary Kenyan citizen by birth. However, a permanent resident isn't entitled to own a freehold at agricultural land. In essence, a permanent resident is considered a foreigner, and hence can only own leasehold tenure, not be exceeding 99 years. Foreigners and Ardisasa Land System. Both residents and non-resident foreigners who own land property here in Kenya, and especially in Nairobi County, are entitled to create an Ardisasa account through the prescribed procedures. Challenges of trying to obtain residency status and their solutions. Obtaining resident status in Kenya through investment comes with several risks and challenges that potential applicants must carefully navigate. Bureaucratic hurdles, such as delays in processing permits and unclear application procedures, can frustrate the process. Stringent requirements, including proof of substantial investment capital, $100,000, and demonstrating economic benefit to Kenya, may be difficult for some investors to meet. Moreover, the renewal of temporary permits every 2 years creates uncertainty, as there is no guarantee of approval for subsequent renewals. Legal and regulatory complexities around property ownership, particularly the restriction of foreigners to leasehold tenure, may pose challenges, especially for agricultural investments requiring large tracts of land. Additionally, navigating Kenya's legal framework without adequate local knowledge or professional advice can expose investors to risks like fraud, title disputes, or failure to comply with local laws. Lastly, the 7-year residency requirement for permanent residence or citizenship may feel prolonged, especially for investors seeking quicker returns or greater security for their investments. However, solutions do exist. Seeking experienced immigration consultants or legal advisors can streamline the application and renewal processes, ensure compliance with all immigration laws, and ensure the maintenance of up-to-date licenses and tax obligations. Legal and regulatory complexities around property ownership, particularly the restriction of foreigners to leasehold tenure, may be overcome by working with local experts to navigate property laws conduct due diligence and secure valid land titles, which subsequently reduces fraud risks. Conclusion: acquisition of residency in Kenya through investment in real estate and agricultural sectors is dependable on various key factors, and noting that the purchase of property in Kenya requires thorough due diligence, hence it is important to seek adequate advice with respect to the same. Disclaimer: this article is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice. The Supreme Court's landmark decision on the doctrine of bona fide purchaser, by article by Linda Mokaya and Joyce Mwara. On 21 April 2023, the Supreme Court delivered its landmark judgment in the Diner Management Limited v. County Government of Mombasa and five others, 2022, KEC 24, KLR, addressing the applicability of the bona fide purchaser doctrine. The dispute concerned a parcel of land located in Niali Beach, Mombasa County, that Diner Management Limited had acquired after conducting due diligence and found no encumbrances. Subsequently, the county government of Mombasa laid claim to the same property, alleging that it was an open space and not private land, and that the open space was reserved for a public road. Supreme Court's findings. The Supreme Court agreed with the findings of the trial and appellate courts that the allocation of the suit property to the first owner, H.E. Daniel Amoy, was irregular. The court reiterated the procedural steps required for allocating unalienated government land, emphasizing that the process begins with planning, followed by surveying. This involves an application to the Chief Land Registrar, after which a letter of allotment is issued outlining conditions to be met. Subsequently, a Part Development Plan, PDP, is drawn and approved by the local authority and forwarded to the Director of Physical Planning. Once approved, the PDP and the original letter of allotment is submitted to the Director of Surveys, who prepares a survey plan. From this plan, a deed plan is created, detailing the plot's dimensions. Only after these procedural steps are completed can a grant or title be issued by the Chief Land Registrar. The court noted that the aforesaid procedure was not followed. The court held that merely possessing a title document does not conclusively establish ownership, particularly when the origin of the title is contested. The title holder must prove that the acquisition process adhered to the prescribed legal framework. In this instance, the absence of critical documents, such as the PDP and the letter of allotment based on the approved PDP, demonstrated that the initial allocation was unlawful. Consequently, no valid title could have been transferred to subsequent purchasers, including Diner Management Limited. The court further clarified that the doctrine of bona fide purchaser for value without notice does not apply where a title was obtained irregularly or illegally. It emphasized that purchasers must conduct thorough due diligence to verify the legitimacy of a title before acquisition. Implications of the Supreme Court's decision in property transactions in Kenya. The Diner Management Limited case provides significant implications for property transactions in Kenya, particularly concerning the application and limitations of the bona fide purchaser doctrine. Key implications of the Diner Management case on property transactions. Due diligence is essential but not absolute. While the court's decision underscores the importance of conducting due diligence, it also highlights that due diligence alone may not protect a purchaser where the root of the title is flawed. The court made it clear that purchasers cannot rely on the doctrine should the allocation of the land be flawed through illegality or irregularity. Possession of title is not conclusive evidence of ownership. The court emphasized that it is not enough for a party to state that they have a lease or title to the property. Possession of a title or lease is an end product of a process. Purchasers must verify the legitimacy of the original allocation process, which in this case included the existence of a valid Part Development Plan, PDP, letter of allotment, and compliance with procedural steps. Limitations of the bona fide purchaser doctrine. The doctrine of bona fide purchaser for value without notice cannot protect a purchaser if the original title was acquired through irregular or illegal means. This case sets a precedent that a title derived from a defective route cannot be regularized by subsequent transactions, even if the purchaser acted in good faith. The Torren systems and the doctrine of bona fide purchaser. The Torren system of registration places a premium on the accuracy of the land register and insists that the register must mirror all currently active registrable interests affecting a particular parcel of land. The Torren system of registration vouches for the sanctity of title. The doctrine of the sanctity of title posits that once a bona fide purchaser for value without notice is registered as the proprietor of the subject parcel of land, it is conclusive evidence that the person named therein is the owner, and thus indefeasible against the entire world, including the original owner, except on grounds of fraud, corruption, misrepresentation, being obtained unprocedurally, illegality, being obtained through a corrupt scheme, all of which the holder of the title must have partaken, and further except on grounds of the leases, charges and other encumbrances, and to the conditions and restrictions, if any, shown in the register. Liabilities, rights and interests as affect the same and are declared by Section 28 of the Land Registration Act not to require noting on the register. In Kenya, the tenets of the Torren system have been codified in both our Constitution of Kenya, 2010, and the Land Registration Act. Article 40 of the Constitution of Kenya guarantees the right to property and provides protection from arbitrary deprivation. However, it removes protection of title to property that is found to have been unlawfully acquired. Section 26, 1, A and B of the Land Registration Act provides that a certificate of title issued by the registrar upon registration or to a purchaser of land upon a transfer or transmission by the proprietor, shall be taken by all courts as prima facie evidence that the person named as proprietor is the absolute and indefeasible owner, subject to specified exceptions such as fraud or illegality. However, the Supreme Court in its judgment diverged from the Torren system principle, asserting that a purchaser can only rely on it if they can prove their status as a bona fide purchaser and thoroughly examine the origins of the title they possess. The Black's Law Dictionary, 8th edition, defines a bona fide purchaser as one who buys something for value without notice of another's claim to the property and without actual or constructive notice of any defects in or infirmities, claims or equities against the seller's title. One who has in good faith paid valuable consideration for property without notice of prior adverse claims. The concept of the Torren system principle and the doctrine of bona fide purchaser are based on the same underlying principle. Historically, courts have held that purchasers could rely on the protection offered under Section 26 of the Land Registration Act. This position was grounded in the principle that the responsibility for ensuring the accuracy of the land register and the authenticity of titles rests with the government rather than individuals. By law, the government is required to provide compensation for any fraud or errors that occur during the registration process. In the case of Tarabana Company Limited versus Sehmi and seven others, 2021 EKLR, the Court of Appeal addressed the doctrine of bona fide purchaser concerning a property dispute over LR number 209/2759/9 in Nairobi's Ngara area. The court determined that Tarabana Company Limited was a bona fide purchaser for value without notice of any defects in the title. Despite the original acquisition of the property being illegal, the court held that the appellant's title was indefeasible as the company was not involved in the initial illegality and had conducted due diligence before purchasing the property. Conversely, in Dina Management case, the court required purchasers to investigate the root of the title thoroughly, ruling that titles acquired through unlawful means cannot be legitimized by subsequent transactions, regardless of the purchaser's innocence or due diligence. Conclusion: the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Dina Management Limited, by County Government of Mombasa, and five others, has significantly redefined the application of the bona fide purchaser doctrine in Kenya. It underscores that the possession of a title document alone is not conclusive proof of ownership if the root of the title is tainted by irregularity or illegality. The judgment places a greater responsibility on purchasers to conduct thorough due diligence beyond the conventional checks, emphasizing the need to verify the entire chain of title acquisition to ensure compliance with the legal framework. This decision introduces a paradigm shift by reinforcing the principle that property rights are not absolute where the original allocation process was flawed. It serves as a cautionary tale for prospective property buyers, legal practitioners, and real estate investors to approach transactions with heightened scrutiny and diligence. Furthermore, the judgment highlights the limitations of the torrens system in the Kenyan legal context, affirming that indefeasibility of title cannot override irregular or illegal initial allocations. Thorough due diligence should involve tracing the root of the title. This goes beyond merely obtaining a certificate of search and avoiding the assumption that the registered owner holds an absolute and indefeasible title. Tracing the root of the title entails taking the following steps. A. Obtain an official land search from the relevant land registry to confirm ownership and any encumbrances, such as charges, caveats, or restrictions. B. Procure the green card which contains historical records of ownership. C. Request for inspection of the deed files and parcel files at the relevant land offices. D. Procure previous transfers to verify the legitimacy of the current owner. E. Review the initial allotment letters, approvals, and gazette notices related to the land, especially for government allocations. F. Cross-checking the property against the Ndungu land report to determine if it was listed as irregularly allocated public land that may be subject to repossession by the government. G. Searching court records to ascertain if the property is subject to ongoing litigation or historical disputes. H. Engaging licensed surveyors to confirm boundaries and that the land corresponds to the registered title. Checking mutation forms and survey plans filed with the Survey of Kenya. I. In cases of inheritance, ensure that succession proceedings were properly conducted and a confirmed grant of probate or letters of administration were obtained before transferring the property. J. Engage with agencies such as the National Land Commission, NLC, to confirm whether the land is public or private, and check compliance with zoning, environmental, and planning regulations. K. Confirm whether rates, rents, and other statutory dues have been paid and obtain clearance certificates. Safeguarding Your Child's Future, The Benefits of Discretionary Trusts article by Shalma Nyambura. Introduction. Parents naturally prioritize the well-being of their children, especially when they are highly dependent minors, requiring constant specialized care. A common concern is how to ensure their child's future care and security in the event of their incapacity or passing. Establishing a discretionary trust provides an effective way to create financial arrangements that safeguard the child's well-being and adapt to their changing needs over time. What is a discretionary trust? A trust is a legal arrangement where a parent appoints a trusted individual, a trustee, to hold and manage funds or assets, the trust fund, on behalf of a specified beneficiary, such as their child. Within this framework, a discretionary trust offers a unique level of flexibility, allowing trustees to exercise judgment and discretion in fulfilling their duties under the trust deed. This ensures that the evolving needs and circumstances of the beneficiaries are met effectively and in their best interests. Due to the wide discretionary powers given to trustees, it is always advisable for a parent to prepare a letter of wishes to accompany the discretionary trust. A letter of wishes sets out the parent's primary requests with regard to the distribution of the trust fund to their children. For example, it can indicate that the child should receive benefit from the trust after obtaining their first degree, or that a large portion of the trust fund should be used to cater for the specialized care of a disabled child, etc. What are the defining features of a discretionary trust? There are three essential features that make a discretionary trust the most preferred form of family trust for parents of minors, children living with disability, or unruly children. They include A. Flexibility. It may be difficult for a parent to predict their children's future interests and needs while creating the trust. Therefore, by establishing a discretionary trust, the trustees can be able to meet the child's evolving financial needs in healthcare, education, sports, and any other legitimate activity that may require financing by the trust. B. Protection. A discretionary trust provides protection to the beneficiaries from their own extravagant choices. For example, it allows the trustees to halt the distribution of trust income to a child, especially when the parent had raised concerns about the child's wasteful lifestyle in their letter of wishes, and there is real concern on how they would cope after inheriting large sums outright. In such a case, the trustees are at liberty to hold and manage the assets of that beneficiary on their behalf and provide occasional and controlled benefits to them. C. Adaptability. A discretionary trust enables the trustees to adapt to the child's changing healthcare, education, and extracurricular requirements, as their powers of distribution of trust fund are not cast in stone. It also makes it easier for the trustees to take advantage and align the trust to any future changes in legislation that may be of benefit to the trust. What is the importance of creating a discretionary trust for your child? Clients with young children often do not wish their children to inherit substantial assets at a young age. Many would prefer their children to obtain a degree, have established careers, or have an understanding of financial matters before they can benefit from the trust. In addition, when children are very young, it is difficult to anticipate their future needs. Some children may require more assistance than others. Discretionary trusts facilitate a wait-and-see approach, enabling parents to choose responsible individuals to assume the guardianship role for their child at a later stage. It also allows the trustees to quickly adapt and facilitate to the changing needs of the child. How can we help? As Nelson Mandela once said, there can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children. Ensuring the financial stability and security of your child's future requires meticulous planning and thoughtful execution. Engaging an experienced private wealth lawyer is an essential first step for any parent aiming to establish a robust and effective discretionary trust. This becomes even more critical when dealing with vast or internationally distributed assets. The Wealth and Private Clients team at CM Advocates LLP brings a wealth of expertise and experience in estate planning across the East African region. With a proven track record in structuring, restructuring, amending, and managing various forms of trusts, the team is well equipped to guide you through the process of creating a valid discretionary trust tailored to your family's unique needs. Written by Shalma E. Maina, The Role of Valuation in Property Tax Assessment in Kenya. Article by Wanjiku Kigwatha. Property tax serves as a vital revenue source for Kenya's county governments, supporting critical services like infrastructure development, education, and public health. Therefore, fair and efficient property tax assessment is pegged on accurate property valuation. Despite its importance, many counties face significant challenges in maintaining updated valuation rolls, leading to revenue leakages and inequities in taxation. What is property valuation? Property valuation is the process of determining a property's monetary worth for various purposes, including taxation. The valuation of properties in Kenya is conducted by the government's Ministry of Lands, Housing and Urban Development, which is responsible for determining the market value of properties in various regions of the country. For property tax, the valuation establishes the tax base by reflecting a property's market value, income-generating potential, or replacement cost. For instance, in Nairobi, the county government uses market-based valuation for properties, linking tax assessments to prevailing real estate trends. This ensures that both residential and commercial properties contribute equitably to county revenue. The connection between valuation and property tax. In Kenya, the Valuation for Rating Act and the Rating Act provide the legal framework for linking property valuation to taxation. Valuation rolls, which contain assessed property values, form the basis for tax calculations. Market value method. This valuation method is common for residential properties, where taxes are pegged to current property values. Income approach. This is applied to commercial properties, with taxes based on income-generating capacity. Replacement cost method. Used for unique properties, with no direct market comparables. Counties apply tax rates to these values to calculate liabilities, which are collected annually or semi-annually. Overview of property taxes. Applicable. Land and real estate transactions attract various taxes, primarily administered by the Kenya Revenue Authority, KRA, and county governments. These include stamp duty, charged on property transfers at rates ranging from 2% to 4% of the property value depending on the location, 2% for rural areas and 4% for urban areas. Capital gains tax, CGT, levied at 15% on the profit realized from the sale of property, and annual land rates, imposed by county governments on landowners based on the property's valuation roll. These taxes ensure that the government derives revenue from land ownership and transactions, although inefficiencies in administration often lead to disparities in compliance and enforcement. Kenyan context, laws and regulations. The Valuation for Rating Act mandates counties to update valuation rolls every 10 years, but this is rarely enforced. For example, in Nairobi, the last comprehensive valuation roll was updated in 1982, until new updates began in 2021, aimed at aligning property values with current market conditions. Inaccurate or outdated valuation rolls have led to significant revenue losses. For instance, a 2021 study by the International Growth Center, IGC, revealed that Nairobi could increase its property tax revenue by over 100% with updated rolls and modern valuation methods. Importance of accurate valuations. Accurate valuations are crucial for equity, preventing overtaxation of low-value properties while ensuring high-value properties pay their fair share. Revenue maximization, boosting county revenue without raising tax rates. Kisumu County, after updating its valuation roll in 2019, reported a 40% increase in property tax collections. Transparency and compliance. Accurate valuations reduce disputes and foster trust in the taxation process. Challenges in valuation for property tax in Kenya. Outdated valuation rolls. Some counties, like Nakuru and Mombasa, rely on rolls prepared decades ago, resulting in underassessments. The result of this is reduced county revenue that would otherwise be utilized in infrastructure improvement, and in turn improve value of property over time. Limited expertise. Kenya has fewer than 300 licensed valuers, insufficient to serve all 47 counties effectively. Also, while most property owners in Kenya are aware of the existence of property rates, they are not knowledgeable on how to calculate their own property tax obligations. Studies undertaken in counties such as Laikipia and Machakos revealed that only about 33% of land owners could calculate their tax obligations. This is a fertile ground for non-compliance and hence impeding. Lack of public support. There is a general lack of trust from the public on any policy reforms spearheaded by the government due to historical financial mismanagement. This is worsened by lack of knowledge on property tax tabulation procedures and citizens' general nonchalance around the correlation between services offered by government and the revenue collected from the taxes. Technological gaps. Few counties leverage geographic information systems, GIS, or automated valuation models, AVMs, which are standard in more advanced economies. These technologies make the valuation process faster, more accurate, and less costly for parties involved. The future of property tax valuation in Kenya. Modernizing property tax valuation is critical for Kenya's development agenda. A report by the World Bank in 2022 estimated that modern valuation practices could triple Kenya's property tax revenue, funding urban development and essential services. Key reforms that need implementation include adopting technology. Counties like Nairobi and Kiambu are piloting GIS-based systems for real-time property data updates, which will go a long way in reducing cost and enhance accuracy of valuation procedures. Capacity building. There is a need to train more certified valuers and establish public-private partnerships to address expertise shortages. Policy reforms. Streamlining valuation update timelines and incorporating citizen engagement to enhance transparency. Conclusion. Efficient property valuation is the cornerstone of an equitable and structured property tax system. By addressing the challenges of outdated roles, limited expertise, and technological gaps, counties can unlock the full potential of property taxation. Accurate and fair valuations will not only enhance county revenues, but also foster trust and compliance among property owners, ensuring sustainable growth in the real estate sector. Stuck with a caution registered against land? Let's help you withdraw it. Article by Anna K. Wanjohi. In this article, we will help you understand what a caution is, who can register it, the grounds of its registration, the effect of its registration, how it can be withdrawn, and the effects of its withdrawal. A caution is an encumbrance placed, registered against a land register by a claimant, known as a cautioner, who A. claims the right, whether contractual or otherwise, to obtain an interest in any land, lease or charge, capable of creation by an instrument registrable under the Land Registration Act No. 3 of 2012, the Act. Such interest may be a purchaser's interest by virtue of an agreement for sale, a beneficial interest, a spousal interest, etc. B. is entitled to a license, or C. has made an application for a bankruptcy order against the proprietor of any registered land, lease, or charge. The effect of a caution once registered against the target land register is that no action can be taken in relation to the land without first notifying the cautioner. How can a caution be withdrawn from the land register? The various ways for the withdrawal of a caution are outlined under Section 73 of the Act. They are 1. Withdrawal by the cautioner. Here, the cautioner voluntarily initiates the withdrawal of the caution by completing the prescribed from L.R. A69, known as the withdrawal of a caution. 1. This application is presented to the relevant land registry, and the registrar proceeds to remove the caution from the land register, and on application, issues a post-registration title search to that effect. One of the frequently asked questions is whether application for the removal of a caution is stamped with stamp duty, to which it is not. 2. Removal by order of the court. This entails approaching the court by filing a suit against the cautioner, on the basis of which the court may issue an order directing the registrar of titles to withdraw the caution. Once issued, the applicant obtains a certified copy of this court order, which is then presented for registration at the relevant registry where the land is registered. It is important to mention that the land registrar may seek the authentication of the court order from the court that issued it. This has been occasioned by the presentation of fake court orders for registration. 3. Removal by order of the registrar. Here, the land registrar may, on the application of any interested person, serve a notice on the cautioner, warning the cautioner that the caution will be removed at the expiration of the time stated in the registrar's notice. The process of issuance of the registrar's order is as follows. I. An interested person makes an application by way of the prescribed form LRA 70, the application to remove a caution. Tai. The registrar may then serve a notice by way of prescribed form LRA 71, the notice of intention to remove a caution to the cautioner, warning the cautioner that the caution will be removed at the expiration of 30 days, the objection period. If the cautioner does not raise any objection to such withdrawal within the objection period, the prescribed form in which the cautioner is required to raise an objection is form LRA 72, the notice of objection to removal of a caution. Tai. If the cautioner does not raise any objection at the expiry of the objection period, the registrar may remove the caution. IV. However, if the cautioner objects to the removal of the cautioner must notify the registrar, in writing in the said form LRA 72, of the objection within the objection period. V. The registrar then proceeds to issue a hearing notice to the cautioner and the proprietor by way of the prescribed form LRA 73, the notice for the hearing on application to remove a caution, specifying the date and time when the hearing is to be conducted, and requiring the parties to appear before the registrar with the relevant original and copies of documents supporting their claim. And the registrar must, after giving the parties an opportunity to be heard, make such order by the prescribed form LRA 74, the order of the registrar on application to remove a caution, as the registrar considers fit, and may in the order provide for the payment of costs. It is worth noting that the removal by the registrar is discretionary. Thus, if the registrar does not exercise the registrar's discretion to proceed to remove the caution where the cautioner has not raised any objection within the said period, then the applicant should consider proceeding to obtain a court order, even though this may impact on time, as its expedition is based on the court's diary, among other formalities. For purposes of the effectiveness and timely receipt of any notices under this method, or for any other purposes, parties should always ensure that their latest postal address are updated at the Lands Registry, as the registrar uses the last known address of the parties as appearing in the Land Register. 4. Withdrawal where a chargee has exercised the chargee's statutory power of sale, with the caution having been registered after the charge. Where a chargee sells land in exercise of its statutory power of sale, the registrar must, within 30 days from the date of the registration of the transfer by chargee, withdraw any caution that was registered after the charge had been registered. While such an instance rarely occurs, we have recently successfully invoked this provision in which we were representing a chargee who exercised their statutory power of sale of charged land, where two cautions had been registered after the registration of their charge. Effects of removal of a caution. On the withdrawal or removal of a caution, its registration against the Land Register must be cancelled. Any liability of the cautioner, previously incurred as a result of the registrar's refusal to accept a further caution by the same cautioner, or anyone on behalf of that cautioner, in relation to the same matter as a previous caution, must not be affected by such cancellation. Meanwhile, the registered owner of the land may proceed to deal with the land as it is no longer encumbered. All prescribed forms are found in the Land Registration General Regulations 2017.
Enforcing a sale agreement article by Ambrose Waigwa. Enforcing a sale agreement. Once the vendor and purchaser have executed a sale agreement, if either party breaches any of its provisions, the non-breaching party may seek various remedies. The parties may outline specific remedies in the sale agreement. However, the omission of such provisions does not deprive the aggrieved party of any recourse, as both common law and the LSK conditions of sale incorporated in most sale agreements will apply as appropriate. Furthermore, the aggrieved party may also invoke common law and equitable remedies. Specific performance. Specific performance is an order that the court may issue directing a party to perform or refrain from a specific action. A party seeking specific performance orders must first demonstrate that they have complied with their obligations under the contract. In the case of Alton Homes Limited and another V. Davis, Nathan Chelagoy, and two others, 2018 EKLR The court held that, further, it is trite that a party seeking an order of specific performance must show and satisfy the court that he it can comply, and that it must be ready, willing, and able to do so, and not just mere allegations. Further, the said party must show proof that he it has complied with his its part of the agreement. Further, in the case of Garib Suleiman Garib versus Abdulrahman Mohammed Agil, LLR, number 750, CAK, cited in the case of Collins v. Ogangu, Civil Appeal, 427 of 2018, 2024, KECA 19, KLR, the court held that the jurisdiction to order specific performance is based on the existence of a valid and enforceable contract, and being an equitable relief. Such relief is more often than not granted, where the party seeking it cannot obtain sufficient remedy by an award of damages, the focus being whether or not specific performance will do more perfect and complete justice than an award of damages. Rescission. Once a contract is rescinded, it ceases to exist. The case of Onyango and another v. Njiriri, Environment and Land Case Civil Suit, 219 of 2018, 2022. Kielk 3701, KLR, held that in the event of default, the innocent party, in this case, the plaintiffs, were entitled to rescind the contract. For clarity, the contract was indeed rescinded, and same therefore ceased to exist in the eyes of the law. Prior to rescinding a sale agreement, the defaulting party first has to be notified of the nature of their default, and given a timeline within which they ought to rectify that default, as held in the case of Gateren Jamunyu versus Josek Njuenyaga, 1983, EKLR. Further, under LSK condition, 13.1.1 provides as follows. 13.1.1. No compensation is payable, nor may the agreement be rescinded in respect of any description, measurement, or quantity, which is substantially correct, nor in respect of any matter of which the purchaser has notice under subconditions 4.5.2, 7.2.5, or 16.1. The Court of Appeal in the case of Housing Company of East African Ltd v Board of Trustees, National Social Security Fund and two others, 2018, EKLR, cited in the case of Onyango, and another v Njiriri, Environment and Land Case Civil Suit 219 of 2018. 2022, Kielk 3701 KLR, however, put limitations to when a vendor can rescind a contract. It declared itself thus, this court is reminded that the law on rescission of a contract for sale of land is to the effect that if the contract contains a condition entitling the vendor to rescind on the happening of certain events, and those events happen, then the vendor may rescind. In the absence of such a condition, the vendor may rescind only if the purchaser's conduct is such as to amount to a repudiation of the contract and the parties can be restored to their former position. See Halsbury's Law of England, Volume 42, 4th edition, at paragraph 242, in this respect. Once a party rescinds the agreement, if the defaulting party is the vendor, they ought to return the deposit paid by the purchaser. As held in the case of Ayub Ndungu versus Marion Waithera, Gacheru, 2006, EKLR, that the law requires that in the case of rescission of a contract for the sale of land, the vendor returns the deposit to the purchaser. However, if the purchaser is the defaulting party, it ought to return any documents issued to them for performing due diligence. When the courts exercise their discretion and allow the innocent party to rescind an agreement for sale, the agreement becomes void ab initio. The LSK condition 13.1.6 provides that where the purchaser has not attributed to the rescission by breaching their obligations, they are entitled to the deposit and any accrued interest and required to return to the vendor any of their documents. Damages. This includes both general and special damages. In the case of Inritho versus Karithi and another, 1988 KLR 237, cited in the case of Collins v. Ogango, Civil Appeal 427 of 2018. 2024, KECA 19, KLR, this court held that it has the power to award damages in lieu of specific performance in the following terms. In all cases in which the court has jurisdiction to entertain an application for an injunction against a breach of any covenant, contract or agreement, or against the commission or continuance of any wrongful act, or for the specific performance of any covenant, contract or agreement, it shall be lawful for the same court, if it thinks fit, to award damages to the party injured, either in addition to or in substitution for an injunction or specific performance, and such damages may be assessed in such manner as the court shall direct. General damages. In the case of Addis Viv Gramophone Co. Ltd. 1909, UKHL 564, 1909, AC 488, 47, SLR 564, the court established that damages for injured feelings or psychological harm are not usually available in an action for breach of contract. A sale agreement is contractual, and a party is, therefore, unable to seek general damages for breach of the contract. This position was reiterated in the case of Kenya Power and Lighting Company Limited v. Abel M. Momei Birundu, 2015, EKLR, and China Overseas Engineering Company Limited v. Isaac Kichwen Kijo, 2019 EKLR, where the court held that where there is a breach of contract, general damages are not awarded. Special damages. The general rule for special damages is that they ought to be specifically pleaded and specifically proved, failure to which such claim will be unsuccessful. This was stated in the case of Han versus Singh, Civil Appeal No. 42 of 1983, 1985. KLR 716 at page 717 and 721, where the learned judges have held that dash. Special damages must not only be specifically claimed, pleaded, but also strictly proved, for they are not the direct, natural, or probable consequence of the act complained of and may not be inferred from the act. The degree of certainty and particularity of proof required depends on the circumstances and nature of the acts themselves. In the above Kenya Power case, the appellate court directed that special damages were more appropriate in a breach of a contract case. The court stated as follows. In this case, the respondent claimed damages for breach of contract. This, in our view, was a special damage claim, which should have been specifically pleaded and strictly proved. As the respondent did not consider it a special damage claim, he did not specifically plead the same and, of course, could not lead evidence on the same. Clearly, therefore, the award of 200,000 Kenyan shillings as general damages was, with due respect to the learned judge, not proper. Injunctions. This is an order issued by the court in an existing suit, pending its determination to either compel or refrain apart from doing an action. Injunctions are not issued as a right and are discretionary to the court depending on the facts of the case. A party seeking an injunction has to prove the provisions in the case of Giella Vith Casman Brown, which are 1. There must be prima facie case. 2. The applicant must show some irreparable injury which cannot be sufficiently compensated by damages. And 3. The balance of convenience must favor the applicant. Forfeiture. For agreements that incorporate the LSK condition, condition 13.4.1 provides that where the purchaser breaches in the performance of their obligations, even on being served with a completion notice, the vendor may declare forfeited 10% of the purchase price and any accrued interest. Further, the vendor may resell the property to any other willing seller. Resale of the property and suing for the loss incurred in the resale. This remedy is only available to the vendor where, due to the purchaser's default, the contract was frustrated and necessitated a resale. LSK condition 13.6 provides that dash, dash. If on any resale contracted within 1 year after the completion date and the vendor incurs a loss, the purchaser must pay to the vendor as liquidated damages the amount of such loss. The liquidated damages payable by the purchaser will include all costs and expenses reasonably incurred in any such resale or any attempted resale. But the vendor must give credit for any deposit and any money paid on account of the purchase price, and the vendor will be entitled to retain any surplus money from the resale. Conclusion. Once a sale agreement is executed, if either party breaches its terms, the non-breaching party can seek remedies under common law and LSK conditions of sale, even if not specified in the agreement. These remedies may include specific performance requiring the breaching party to fulfill contract terms, rescission, cancelling the contract, damages, both general and special, with special damages needing specific pleading and proof, injunctions to prevent or compel actions during a pending case, and forfeiture, where the vendor may forfeit 10% of the purchase price for the purchaser's breach. Additionally, if the purchaser defaults and the vendor resells the property, the purchaser may be liable for any loss incurred in the resale.